In my paper, I want to talk about the first, what would be the first steps of a philosophy of housing, because there's not, almost no work that has been done in housing by philosophers, and it's a good question to ask. Why have philosophers not been interested at all? Almost not all. There's one person, Peter King, who does some work. He develops a libertarian framework to justify the absence of state intervention in housing. Friedrich Hayek did a kind of a brûlot, like we say in French, on rent control, saying it was a disaster. And in the left field, there's almost absolutely nothing on housing, except Engels, who did a book in the 1850s on Questions du logement. So there's almost nothing that has been done by philosophers on the issue of housing. And it's a good question to ask, why have philosophers not been interested in housing? Is it the case that there's no philosophical interest to have on housing, about housing? So the first part of the paper asks the question, why should we be interested or not in housing as philosophers, or why have philosophers not been interested in housing? And so I have different kind of explanation I go around to. So it's certainly not because housing is private, even if Daniel's kind of saying that could be a reason. I still think there's a lot of private things that philosophers are interested into, like sexuality, for instance. And it's not because they live in houses and they want to buy houses, because they don't live in hospitals and they're interested by health issues, for instance. So there has to be some other reasons. You could say that they're more interested by a general framework of inequality. They're more interested by what is a contract, what is consent, what is a voluntary exchange. And these are abstract notions that philosophers like to think in an abstracted way. And they would gladly put housing in the hands of urban planners or housing people and think themselves about the concepts that drive housing issues and apply it to all different sorts of things. But this, I don't find, if that's the case, that I think that's a mistake, because there are many issues in housing that could interest philosophers. And one of the issue is that, is it really a voluntary exchange? When we have an exchange between bankers and owners and renters, are we really on a voluntary basis? Are these people consenting to what they're going into? And that could be a very interesting case study for philosophers, but they have not done it. Maybe one of the reasons is that private property is really deeply entrenched in our society. And if we want to answer the problems that private property creates, well, maybe philosophers are pragmatic in the sense that they would say that, well, let's try to answer these problems without displacing private property, because there may be some kind of allergic to any big revolution on the in those normative ideas, such as private property. And they would prefer solutions that will answer these problems without going right through to private property. So in a sense, they would prefer to tweak institutions such as private property, contracts, the state institutions that regulate these things without systematically rethinking everything. But if that's the case, I think that's also a mistake, because there are many evidence that show that the contractual relationship that ties lenders, owners, and renters form some kind of a structure of domination that will enrich the richest people and impoverish the poorest persons. And I was happy that Nick cited Mark Scholko. I never thought it would be cited here. But he did a really good work in showing how the crise de logement in Montreal was really driven by some some domination between the real estate developers and the city officials and the renters and the poor persons. And there's also a lot of work that has been done on that question of how the residential market, the public policies, and the different types of housing regulations can and are used as instruments of domination. So if that is true, then we really have to go into that messy world of housing and look how is poverty embedded in real estate, and how are people that rent or buy houses are impoverished just by the fact that this structure exists as it is. And I think philosophers have a duty to look into housing and poverty. In the part of my paper where I look into housing and poverty, I look exclusively on the problem of rental housing. The reason is because renters are, for instance, have half the median income than owners. Renters are much more poorer than owners. So my hypothesis here in my first steps of a philosophy of housing is that there's a social structure of housing that is partly responsible for the poverty of renters. And it could be that there exists poverty in owners, but in Montreal, I think that owners' poverty is just a simple case of poverty in general. It's not really a case that they are being dominated by that structure. Maybe in other parts of the world, there's also owners' poverty that is driven by a structure of housing that is impoverishing owners. In Montreal, there are about 750,000 households. I will use the household because that's what we have in the statistics. I know that it could be more precise to talk about individuals, but this is what I have. And about almost 66% of all these households are rental housing, which is probably the biggest proportion in all North America. And of these 488,000 renting households, about 44% are low-income households. And 33% of these 488,000 households are living squarely below the poverty line. And if you want to have a better image of these numbers, we can look at what we call in French taux d'effort, which is the front ratio. It's the effort rate you pay of your income for rent. The effort rate of Montreal households is pretty impressive in the rental sector. Nearly two households out of five will spend more than 30% of their income on housing, which is considered as a poverty situation. And one household in five, in fact, pay more than 50% of their income on housing, which is to say that about 150,000 households, with a lot of families and children, are in a very, very precarious situation. Because, you all know that housing spending is a fixed spending. You cannot try to negotiate your housing spending. And what's more, it's very hard to find a cheaper housing when you're spending a lot of money on housing. It means that probably you're stuck there. The other thing about poverty, about the incomes and the housing, there's a growing gap between the salaries and the rents we pay, especially for low-income persons. In the last 10 years, the low incomes have only risen about 16% in 10 years. That's about 1.6% per year. While the highest incomes have risen on an average of 47.6%. So the low incomes are rising very, very slowly. The high incomes are rising very fast. While the rents, but this I don't have any number for that, this is an interview I made, cheap rents are escalating at a much higher pace than high rents, because cheap rents, owners want to bring them to the level of the market, they call it. And also a poor person and low-income person are more vulnerable to these kind of tactics than are higher income persons. So again, this, I don't have any numbers on that. This is a done from an interview. Another injustice we can see is that, for example, the legal minimum salary will only account for about, we'll have to spend 40% of the salary for paying the rent. So already the legal minimum salary is already in a poverty situation. But there is more to housing poverty than just a gap in income between the rich and the poor persons. As in most cities, low-income Montrealers will generally live in rental housing and apartments that are will be in need of major repairs, will be scattered in very far neighborhoods, and will exhibit many problems such as widespread poverty, poor municipal services, gang violence, etc. So low-income dwellers experience not only worse situation than others, but they experience also a sense of abandonment from the politicians, because it's not being taken into account. A public spokesperson will rarely take a stance on housing conditions. There's also a growing body of scholarship that exposes the hidden costs of poor housing conditions. For example, you have such costs as internet services, appliances, and they turn out to be very used in with the low-income people. The low-income people, they don't have a fridge, they don't have appliances. They will have to pay for internet that the owners take a profit from. I have seen a lot of things in that sector that is very very discouraging. And the other kind of cost, they call there's a study that calls it the sequential cost of housing, which are the serial cost of being poor. If you have a poor house, you probably live in a poor neighborhood. Mental illnesses. You will be in a food desert. You will not go out of your house because of the insecurity. Therefore, your physical activity, well-being, will be lower. So there's a lot of latent and sequential costs that are attached to low incomes and their rental their housing situation, especially in rental housing, which most people that have rental incomes are into. So we have all these problem of unhealthy, unsafe, badly serviced housing, the latent and sequential cost. But these are all just numbers, and to look at these numbers in a more to look at these numbers from a moral point of view, then we have to take a philosophers in board. This is where philosophers will come in, because they have a lot of experience in philosophical theory in moral philosophical theories. There are many ways we can look into the moral issues of housing. And my own take on this is to see how a participative process could answer some of the problems, not all the problems, could answer some of the problems, and particularly the asymmetrical bargaining powers between renters and owners. This is a big problem, I think. And also all the interests of the renters that are not being taken into account by the policies at the city level. I think that we have many kinds of philosophical framework to take account of the interests to look and try to philosophize about the interests of renters, but not much progress, I think, can be made with other theories than the participative theories. For instance, Peter King, the philosopher, the only philosopher that's ever written on housing, Peter King tries to talk about the autonomy of agents. This is his big criteria. We have to respect the autonomy of agents. Everybody can have a self-interest, and every individual know how to negotiate is in better place to negotiate his or her self-interest with other individuals. But the problem here is that we don't have a voluntary exchange in order to respect the autonomy of agents in the housing sector. First of all, like I hinted to, owners possess much more bargaining powers than renters. They can discriminate between renters, they can raise the rent steeply, and usually renters will accept a rent sharp raise to avoid conflict. They can repossess, they can renovate, they can subdivide, they can transform a condo, they can demolish an apartment, they can intimidate the renters with all these powers they have. They can use tactics to pressure renters in moving out. They can influence legislators through very efficient lobbying. And they can also influence by doing nothing when they are asked to do some repairs or to step in. On the other hand, renters do not have much more than three limited bargaining powers. They can resist rent raises that they consider abusive. They have a right to stay in the apartment if they wish to, although it is a limited right. For instance, in Quebec, we have the reprise de logement. So if you're an owner and you can bring in your father or your child to reprendre le logement, and 6 months after, well, your father or your child will move elsewhere and you can sell or raise the rent of the apartment. And it's used in a lot in poor sectors of town. Renters have a right to stay in the apartment, but it is a limited right. And they can also influence regulation through advocacy groups, but in a very limited way. So we don't have here a equilibrated bargaining powers that could make it to be a voluntary exchange between renters and owner. But a second objection to the criterion of voluntary exchange or autonomy of renters and owners is that the housing is very non-elastic and bulky. You're stuck with it. It is very hard to move out of your house. There's a lot of hardships and costs of moving elsewhere. And sometimes, even if you're paying a high rent and you have bad housing conditions, well, if you want to move, it's going to be even worse. You're going to move in slum housing or something like that. So once again, it's not very voluntary here. So this is just a case of how I would resist to all different philosophical approach to impose some kind of general criteria that would theorize the moral incomes and outcomes, inputs and outputs of the housing sector, because I think the most important thing is that renters have to have a general interest to participate in the institutions that will arrange in order their own interests. Whether these are institutions that will conceptualize housing, organize the provision of shelters and the modes of tenures, or plan urban services. The reason is because there's a diversity of actors in housing and also in the rental sector. There is a big diversity of actors, and it's very hard to have some kind of general abstract theory to place all the interests of every person in place and say, well, this is how things have to play out. So I think we have a duty to consider all interests of all parties, and, well, a participative theory answers to that duty. There's also an efficiency of participation. In the Montreal districts, where we have more participative structures, you will see in these districts there will be more social housing. People will have the rents will be lower than other sectors where it's less participative. So there's also a good efficiency to participative structures. And there's a last thing that I talk about in my paper. It is about resident participation. These are experiments that have been tried in France to have some Organisation Nationale d'Usagers and Accord Collectif de Location, which is when you have big owners, and the rules of the game are pretty much put in place by the big owners in the rental sectors. But the problem is that renters are are individualized in front of big owners that have a lot more powers. So in France, the way they answer that problem is to give the renters the possibility to collectivize in a given block, or when you have owners that have multiple blocks. And for such things such as repairs, rent raises, or even the sale of the building, then there has to be some deliberation and negotiation between the owner and the Collectif National d'Usagers. This has been tried in France, but the experiments are not going so well. One reason, I think, is because there's not a lot of political will to advance these experiments. So anyways, these are my my first steps into a philosophy of housing, which would take as a first step a participative process to take into account the interests, especially of renters in the rental sector, in order to answer the problem of poverty, to stop land speculation and housing speculation from having bad impacts on renters. So there you go.
Thank you. Alors, merci beaucoup, c'était super intéressant. C'est plutôt un commentaire, I'll give it in English, but it was very interesting. But I was struck by when you were talking just about the lack of philosophy about housing. It's been a while since I've read Aristotle, but I wonder if a philosophy of housing might have something to do with, might be sort of a point of articulation between the public and private sphere. It almost seems that, again, it's been a while, but it's sort of, well, that's something that distinguishes the private sphere from the political sphere. And that might be a hangover for the last 2,000 years, but as you point out, it might be time to do away with that. Anyway, just a thought. I'd be interested in your thoughts, but there's also lots of others. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, your commentary touches to my very last sentence of my paper. I said, at the end of the day, the point I want to make is that housing is not an individual, but a collective affair. And that's why I think philosophers must step in.
Well, sort of switches housing out of this private sphere that I think it's been conceived of into, it politicizes it, which is neat.
Like, for instance, people are saying, well, if you accept a rent raise, then it's an individual decision. It's your decision, you can afford it, then it's your, but the persons after you will have to absorb these raises. And another thing, when you look at the collective price, if we accept all the raises that owners say, well, we need to make these raises in order to repair the apartments, are much higher, the collective prices of what owners would impose on renters in order to do the repairs and maintain the rental sector, is much higher than just deliver grants to owners in order to make these repairs and do the maintenance. So there's always a collective question behind housing.
Thanks. I have a comment, a question, and a comment / question. First, just a comment you might want to add to your things to consider is the exploitative relations between owners and lenders. It's obviously a huge issue in the United States, just to add to the mix of things for you to consider. But I want to put you on the spot a little bit and ask you, do you think that non-voluntary renting is inherently unjust and exploitive? Is it the case where anytime someone would rather that they could have their own house but are forced because of economic necessity to rent, is that an inherently unjust, wrong thing that we should try to eliminate? And then the third comment / question is has to do with what your take is on the role of public housing in this. In the U.S., certainly the public housing authorities can be just as neglectful, just as disrespectful of the residents as any absentee landlord, and often just at the very bottom of the barrel, bare floor minimum. So since we might think that the state is a greater responsibility or than that to provide some sort of decent minimum beyond the bare bones minimum and to actually raise the floor. And finally, and this connects to the last thought, is it seems like to really get this off the ground, you would need some kind of account of what is decent housing. What is the minimum decent housing level that's appropriate for for someone to be included in the community, and you know, and both what that looks like in practice and what the normal justification for it is. Otherwise, presumably the answer would just bid everything down and make things cheaper and cheaper to all end up in shacks. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yes, I take your suggestion of building an account of what is a decent housing. As for no, I would not say that everyone must move to ownership in order to answer the problem. I would argue for a plurality of tenures. So for many persons, rental is a good solution for what they want to do with their life. For instance, me, I want to travel and I want to put some money in some kind of fund somewhere that will provide for me when I'll be old. And I don't want a house. I don't want to take care of a house, and
Is non-voluntary renting. So I understand that some people choose to rent, but I'm talking about people who would like to own but cannot because of lack of resources. Okay. Is that unjust?
Okay. Yes, but that could probably be a problem of housing speculation, because the reason they don't have enough income to invest in housing is because of housing speculation. And one reason we have housing speculation is because of the conflict of interest we have between real estate and municipal official and municipal public policies, because they have a big interest in speculation. It raises taxes, it brings new revenues, and you make some beautiful announcement when you have some new projects, etc. So, and this answer, I think, your first question about the domination between owners and lenders in the United States. You have, and political officials will come in that structure of domination. So yes, that is unjust. But renters should have a word about how the condition in which they live and the development of their own neighborhoods. So I have in mind not only resident participation right is a relationship between renters and owners. But when you have residents that participate together, they come to know other residents in the same neighborhood or in other neighborhoods that have the same owner. And then you may also be able, as renters, to intervene about the development of your neighborhood. And this is something that cities, I think that cities, that the officials, the conseiller, that there's a few conseillers I know in Montreal, that this is what they want. This is what they wish, that their citizens get involved in the development of the neighborhoods, but they don't. So they're stuck with their real estate developers.
This carries on a tradition in Martin's thinking, which some of you may not know about, and that is that his last major effort in this direction was on the philosophy of the car. And so a terrific book came out of that co-authored on the car, which I can call to people's attention. This is more a comment, really, or you can take it as you want, but I think in keeping with an earlier comment, it might be useful for philosophers, because you're throwing down a challenge to the philosophers, and mainly to philosophers of justice, but such philosophers might also look at what philosophical thinking and work has been done on homes. So Aristotle for sure, Hegel absolutely, and in the same vein. And then the two camps that have mainly addressed this question have been, on the one hand, the utopians, starting with Plato and Fourier, Campanella before Moore, Bacon, almost all of whom were suspicious of homes. They wanted collective living, or if they were homes, they were going to be radically transformed, different kinds of homes, and they brought questions of urban design into it. And then the last category would be the phenomenologists, and the best known, of course, being Heidegger, and who concerned themselves with the notion of the homeness of homes. I'm not sure what philosophers of justice can learn from these people with respect to homes, or anything else, but
you're going to make Martin abandon the project.
But for what it's worth, it might be worth looking at such.
Yes, in French, French books, I found the one that's called "Qu'est-ce qu'habiter?" So this is the basic Heideggerian question, Kissick, something, and then you put a verb. And now it's habité. So habité is for these philosophers, it's what you can't say about home, what you cannot put in words. And you read the whole book, and really, it's that. They cannot put it into words. So I have nothing to say about that. I'm sorry. Really.
Perfectly good Heidegger.
Yeah. These are good suggestions to look into these. There's a bit of dust there in these corners, and maybe see what could be interesting about the utopians. The problem with pure like pure collectivized housing is that there's a lot of people that they don't want to live with a collectivity and have a big have a reunion meeting for every decision you want to make. Like I've seen that there's a big difference in Montreal between co-ops and subsidized housing. You have subsidized housing for poor persons, low incomes, and they are taken in charge by whatever authority. And it's true that there are some neglect in when government agencies step in to take care of other people and things. And this is why I think there has to be more participation from these persons. But at a certain point in time, you have to admit that these persons don't want to participate. And what do you do with them? They don't want to participate. And they're not good at participating. If they participate, the outcome is not very good. So somehow you have to have some kind of a liberal, regulative, a justice and moral framework. But participation is not going to work with these persons.
Merci, Martin. En fait, ma question, c'est comme un commentaire qui est en fait une question d'éclaircissement. Et elle concerne les structures de domination dont tu as parlé et qui donc se révèlent à travers le concept d'housing et le rapport des propriétaires aux locataires. Et en fait, je pars d'un exemple très concret, mais de Paris, où je reviens et où j'ai habité un peu. Et le prix des loyers est complètement hallucinant, ce qui fait qu'une partie de la population doit déserter la ville, et en particulier les précaires, qui vont donc, ceux qui gagnent le moins d'argent, même qui travaillent, mais qui ont le revenu minimal, donc qui ne peuvent pas habiter dans Paris et qui sont donc obligés d'aller vivre en banlieue, ce qui les met encore plus loin de leur travail, ce qui rend quelque part encore plus difficile leurs conditions de vie à cause du transport qu'ils doivent effectuer tous les jours entre la banlieue et leur lieu de travail, etc. Et donc c'est là-dedans moi, que je verrais une forme de domination, mais une domination qui serait aussi engendrée par un système, le système économique dans lequel on vit et la régulation des prix du marché immobilier, donc qui quelque part échappe à toute possibilité de contrôle de la part des habitants, mais qui répond en fait à un marché d'offre et de la demande et qui explique l'augmentation constante des prix des loyers, notamment par exemple ici à Paris où il y a toujours une très forte demande. Et la question d'éclaircissement que je voulais te poser, et je ne suis pas sûre en fait si tu en as parlé ou si tu en as parlé, c'était assez rapide, mais il me semblait qu'il y avait quelque chose comme une volonté de réguler ces prix-là, les prix de l'immobilier. Mais alors, par quel biais ? Est-ce que ça doit passer par l'État ? Est-ce que sur quels critères ? Enfin voilà, c'est un peu la question d'éclaircissement que je voulais te poser.
So, just for the non-francophones, very quickly, the question had to do with what are the mechanisms. An implication of Martin's paper seems to be that at one point or another, you're going to have to regulate the housing market and housing costs, prices of, and so what is the mechanism through which you might be able to do that? Is that just state intervention the only way, or?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the first thing I want to say, because Laurie also compared the problem in Montreal and the problem in Paris, the problem in France is that the droit au logement is very judiciaire. It's purely at a level of the système judiciaire, and it doesn't really work in reality. If you go down on what's happening in the market between renters and owners, the owners have pretty much all the power they want. The only thing is that renters can live forever if they don't pay their rent. And you need to have a very hard warrant from the police, and it takes a lot of years to throw out your renters. So you have this problem where owners will do everything to block renters that to come in that would not pay. And so they ask for very a lot of deposit of a big caution and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, just a position is not forever. There is a process, and you have to go in front of the justice. It's true, yeah. but you have a date. I think it's 2 years.
Yeah, 2 years.
When you are occupied, and it's a few months in squat situation.
For an owner that has no rent for 2 years, it seems like forever. Okay. And so the problem in France is that there's no real working of the law at the everything that protects the renters is not really working at the level of concrete affairs. Well, in Quebec, at least, I think we have one of the best regulation, everywhere is the Régie du Logement. You look at the law, the rental, how the rental raises are taking on, and it's beautiful. The problem is that the renters don't take advantage of the law. They don't know really what their rights are, and they have no idea that it's really easy for them to be protected. So we have an information problem here. And this is one reason why I insist on participative process, because participative process, I think, is the best way to inform renters of their own rights. So at one level, I think it's important to have statewide or nationwide or whatever regulations to protect the renters. And at another level, I think local participative structures are important to implement these regulations.
Okay, I'll be very quick. Thank you. I thought it was a really thought-provoking paper. Very, very briefly, it seems like you're saying the problem is the imbalance of the bargaining power. And if you define that way the problem, then the solution is changing the imbalance, right? So making it more symmetrical. I wonder why you don't go the full Monty. Why don't you say that the problem is the bargaining? Why don't you go for collective ownership rather than collective bargaining? So that's one question. And the other, very briefly, maybe a reply to Thad's question. It seems to me that you could argue that one of the goods when we can live in a place, whether we own it or whether we rent it for a long time, for a long period, is that we have shelter. And not only in the sense that we have it, but also in the sense that we know that we'll have it tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. This security is very important, so we can plan things in the family. Say we are a young couple, we want to have a baby. We have to know that we have this shelter. We have this house to live in next year so that we can have the baby. And when you have this imbalance, you cannot have it. You may be thrown out every day or next year, and then you cannot plan. So this insecurity, I think, is what's wrong here. I think you could use this argument.
I'm not sure if I understood clearly, so it's a question of clarification mostly. Your talk gave us a sense that there's this group of renter, just one segment, the poorest of the poorest, those people who pay 50% of their salary, put it into their rent, who really suffer dramatically from the situation and are poorly protected, right? There's a group of people who rent and are happy with the conditions as they are. And so you say that by bringing these people into the formulation of regulations or institutional organizations will help to improve their rights or conditions, right? But these are the people that are extremely difficult to reach. There's a very large literature on participatory processes and planning that tell us that single family moms don't have time to it's very time consuming to be poor, or are not comfortable in participating in those political arena situations. Don't have the don't feel that they know how to do that. So my question is, do you mean that we should bring these people into, or is the question why isn't the rest of the renters not speaking for? Why isn't anyone talking for those people who, for different reasons, are not able to further their rights. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I will start the last question. Your question is very important for me. I'm trying, I didn't disclose my my activity in tenants in a tenants' rights group, and I have a lot of problems with trying to have some kind of participatory arena where it's not only people that have these problems that will participate. It's also the persons that can either give a hand or in some way their own actions will worsen the position of low-income persons. Because when you accept a raise, even if you can, like I said, even if you can take the raise, then all the persons behind you will have to take that raise. The other thing is that in most neighborhoods, we have a mixed neighborhood. So people have to be together in order to resist to the speculation problems. So I totally agree, but it doesn't make it easier to say that middle income person or other renters than low income person have to be together with low income and have to think about their impacts of their actions on low income person doesn't make it easier to do it. However, in moral theories, it's not because it's difficult that we don't have to make it. So this is how I would answer from the point of view, but we have to think about how we can efficiently bring about participative process. And I totally agree that it's, from my point of view, it's almost a fiasco, the experiments I tried. I still believe in it, and I think that there could be some regulations that could help these participative processes.
30 seconds to answer
our question. Okay, collective ownership versus regulating.
Ownership versus bargaining.
Yeah, right. So yes, I believe in collective ownership. There has to be, like in Hochelaga-Maisonneuve, a borough of Montreal, it's 50% public housing. In my neighborhood, it's 5%, and I think that my neighborhood should go to the level of Hochelaga-Maisonneuve. But like I said, I believe in a plurality of different modes of tenure. And when you have a rental housing tenure, then you will need some collective bargaining. And I don't want to bring forth a philosophy of housing that starts with, let's abolish private property. Just like the book I wrote about cars, where at first I started with, let's abolish cars. But then I said, well, maybe the problem is not really cars, it's the unreasonable uses of cars. And I think it's the same thing with housing. The problem is not really private property, it's the unreasonable uses of private property.
Thank you very much, Martin.